So I'm Judith Reppe, and this year I'm in charge of organizing these monthly lectures for CAPE. So if you have ideas or things you want to suggest, just send me an email and we'll take them into consideration. I'm very happy to welcome you all today for the first talk in the spring semester. You know that this is one of the main activities that the CAPE sponsors. And if you're not a member or not on the email mailing list, you should speak to Cindy Robinson, who will be around, and she will take care of that. We're very lucky today to have Joan Brumberg as our speaker. Joan is a Stephen Wise Presidential Fellow and a Professor Emerita at Cornell. She's had a really unique, and I use that word in its real sense, a unique career at Cornell and in the wider world with an interdisciplinary appointment at Cornell in history, human development, and gender studies, which we used to know as women's studies. And she has taught courses in the history of childhood, the history of female adolescence, history of American women in the professions, and the history of American medicine, and she still teaches in the summer session a very good course on that history of medicine topics. She's had a lot of recognition in the wider world. She's been on the Today Show, the Oprah Winfrey Show, the Fresh Air, and many other American Canadian television and radio programs talking about the topics for which she's so well known, issues concerning women and girls, and her books have been translated in languages around the world. She did her undergraduate degree nearby at the University of Rochester. She had her PhD in history from the University of Virginia. And the work for which she will be talking about today is work that she did now some time ago about the history of anorexia, a very important book, Fasting Girls, The Emergence of Anorexia Nervosa as a Modern Disease in the late 1980s, for which won four different major awards, the Berkshire Book for the Conference of Women Historians, the John Hope Franklin Prize in the American Studies Association, the Watson Davis Prize in the History of Science Society, and the Basker Memorial Prize for the Society of Medical Anthropology. And so that gives you a sense of not just how well recognized she is, but the breadth of her interests and what she has to tell us today. So please welcome Joan.
Well, thank you all for coming. Now, is this working? Okay, all right. Let me begin by telling you something I know so many of you in the audience that you probably already know, and that I am not a recovered anorectic, nor am I the mother or the grandmother of one. I'm fortunate. Neither am I a therapist. And I make this distinction at the outset so that you'll understand my perspective. I'm a social and cultural historian, and my interest in eating disorders and body image springs from observations of social change within my own lifetime. In 1965, when I was a senior at the U of R, I had a tutoring job to make money to help pay tuition, which I think was about $1,800 at the time. And I was assigned to Strong Memorial Hospital, the teaching hospital for the U of R, and I was working with a young woman named Sherry. And when I first met her, I thought she was 11 or 12, at the most 13. In fact, she turned out to be 17 years old. She was extremely thin, emaciated, and visibly unhappy. I had no idea what was wrong with Sherry. My first thought was cancer, but the nurse on the floor explained to me that she had anorexia nervosa. And this was the first time I had heard about this disease. I went back to my dorm, this is 1965, and I told all my friends about it with some wonder. No one had ever heard of it. And the notion that it was a kind of extreme dieting, which is how I understood it at the time, generated some skepticism among my friends. By the 1980s, jumping ahead, I was here at Cornell and a faculty member, and the world of women and girls was very different in regard to eating disorders. Everyone had heard of anorexia nervosa, especially after the death in 1983 of Karen Carpenter. You may remember her. By this time, I was teaching a generation of students who grew up reading fiction that included graphic depiction of anorexic girls. I would just say it's kind of the Judy Blume type of fiction. Those of you who are read that stuff may know about that. And there was always a significant number of young women who explained their interest in studying psychology here at Cornell. I know this because I read applications for admission, in terms of eating disorders in high school or junior high. In short, anorexia nervosa was in the talk of women students, and it had become a student personnel issue, generating a host of new campus-wide support and therapy services. The disjuncture between 1965 and 1985 raised a number of questions for me that became the basis of my 1988 book, Fasting Girls. And the questions are simple, but they're critical in terms of understanding where we are today as a culture in terms of women and their bodies. The first question, is anorexia nervosa a new disease? The second, if not, has the disease itself changed over time? And third, why and how does a disease become more prominent in one time period than another? Before taking you back in time to answer these questions, I want to make a brief detour into the issue of etiology or cause of anorexia nervosa. The best model or the best way to think about anorexia nervosa is to acknowledge that it is a multi-determined disorder. In other words, it depends upon an individual's biological vulnerability, her psychological predisposition, by that I mean temperament as well as family setting, and the social and cultural climate. Biology, psychology, culture are all interactive in anorexia nervosa, and they're very hard to untangle. Although I'm generally sympathetic to the idea that diseases are in part socially constructed, I've never relied on a strictly cultural interpretation of anorexia nervosa. Culture alone does not cause it. If it did, everyone exposed to this culture would have it. Clearly, there are some intervening individual psychological variables and maybe even some biological ones that we don't fully know about yet. While we can't blame anorexia nervosa directly on Calvin Klein or Kate Moss or Calista Flockhart or, I better get more recent, Lindsay Lohan, the commercial culture that they represent does account for the increased incidence of the disorder over the past 40 years. In other words, more girls and women are being recruited into extreme dieting as the cultural ideal becomes thinner and thinner, and North Americans come to believe that their bodies are perfectible. So let me go to the first question. Is anorexia nervosa a new disease? Most people are surprised to learn that there was anorexia nervosa before there was Twiggy. Anorexia nervosa was named and identified in the 1870s by William Withy Gull, like the bird, in England, and Charles Lassec in France. Anorexia, meaning lack of appetite, can occur in biomedical diseases like tuberculosis or cancer, but the nervosa in this case meant lack of appetite from nervous or psychological causes. It was not the usual wasting diseases that plagued 19th century medicine. And just as an aside, Dr. Gull was the personal physician to Queen Victoria, who did not have anorexia nervosa, who was always a little miffed, he was always a little annoyed that the disease was not named after him and called Gull's disease. And if you think about it, that's because in the 19th century, doctors were making their reputations and establishing their authority and prestige by having diseases named for them. And we live with that legacy. Addison's, Parkinson's, Hodgkin's, Alzheimer's, Meniere's. I'm sure you could come up with some more. So the naming of anorexia nervosa in medical literature in the 1870s and 1880s doesn't really mean that it didn't exist before. Published reports from at least one American asylum as early as the 1850s revealed that there were adolescent girls aged 16 to 23 from good homes who refused to eat but suffered no other physical or mental disorder. These patients were called cytomaniacs, S-I-T-O, derived from the Greek for bread. In other words, those who feared or loathed their food. Now, because wasting diseases were so prevalent and so critical in the 19th century, the doctor's first task was to determine the source of the emaciation. In general, 19th century physicians concentrated on the problem of what was called differential diagnosis, how to tell one disease from another. That's still going on. And on the reduction of physical symptoms. Not much attention was paid to the psychology of early anorexia nervosa or the question of the patient's motivation. Gull explained the disorder in terms of, these are his words, the morbid perversity of the adolescent girl. All right. Others called it a hysteria for the junior miss. Before Sigmund Freud and the meaning of not eating, before he explored the meaning of not eating, few questions were asked about feelings or emotions. A cure was accomplished, it was thought, when the patient gained weight and added flesh to her frame. And this usually was accomplished by removal from home, which was then called a parentectomy, and a regimen and a regimen of many small meals enforced by a trained nurse. There was also some forced or tube feeding. Now, in Fasting Girls, I tried to penetrate the emotional world of the 19th century anorexic girl, and I proposed that she used the appetite as a voice. In the absence of any 19th century diary by an anorexic that said definitively, I'm not eating because, I never found one like that, all right? I used the techniques and strategies of a social and cultural historian to put together a picture of what food and eating meant to girls in the Victorian world. And I argued that food and eating were loaded with negative meanings, especially for girls of the middle and upper classes, which is exactly where anorexia nervosa was born and also remains by and large. In a nutshell, and I'm summarizing a great deal here, chapter upon chapter, in fact, food and eating were problematic for girls of privilege because they symbolized sexuality and lack of self-restraint. Control of the body and its processes and fluids were important to the Victorian woman. Some did not like to admit defecation or urination, and they would boast that the calls of nature happened to me but a few times a week. That's a direct quote. Many young women wanted to be pure and live an ascetic life without any of the appetites of the flesh. Many were vegetarians because meat was a hot food established with carnality, carnality and sexuality. And the medical advice of the day was interesting. If a girl's menstruation had not occurred by the time she was 16 or 17, the doctor often instructed the mother to add meat to the diet. On the other hand, if a young woman displayed a precocious interest in the opposite sex, her mother was instructed to withdraw meat from the diet. The Victorian anorectic wanted a slim body as a symbol of her distance from the working class. She did not want to look like a milkmaid or a farmer's daughter. To her, robust, being called robust, was an insult. Although historical case records do not say very much about the family life of these anorectics in the 19th century, I suggest a number of familial factors that may have caused the emotional conditions that fed the pathology. Greater affluence and privileging of children, the intensification of family life, meaning fewer children and longer residency at home, which meant the possibility of enmeshment with parents, which is oftentimes considered a characteristic of the contemporary anorexic family. Marital pressures from the family, if anybody's watching Downton Abbey, you know what I'm talking about. Feelings of anger because brothers still had more opportunities and educational options. Although a specific cause is hard to determine then, as now, Victorian girls who did not eat had the power to disrupt family life. These girls were rejecting the most basic of the gifts provided by their bourgeois parents, food. In this emotionally charged and materially privileged environment, the appetite became less of a biological drive and more of a social and emotional instrument. And this is even more true today. The reports of clinicians in the 21st century suggest that appetite disorders exist now in a wide range of psychopathologies, not just in anorexia nervosa. Now, anorexia nervosa remained a rare and exotic disorder well into the 20th century. As late as the 1960s, most physicians had only read about this disorder and they had rarely seen it in their residencies or internships unless they had specialized in psychiatry. By the 1980s, however, pediatricians and internists, as well as psychiatrists, were facing the starving disease up close. Gull's initial description still held. The population group was generally the same, adolescent, and something was happening. Not only was the disease increasing in number, its symptomatology was changing. So this brings me to question number two. Has anorexia nervosa changed over time? And the answer clearly is yes. And of course, what I'm pointing to here is the way in which symptoms will become culturally specific. First, there's the language of presentation. In the 19th century, the Victorian anorectic presented somatic symptoms, not psychological ones. Typically, she said, "I cannot eat because it hurts. Hurts me to swallow." Today, the formulaic statement is, "I don't need to eat, I'm too fat. I have other issues that I'm dealing with." The modern anorectic generally displays a morbid preoccupation with her weight and a dread of fatness, and she usually maintains that her eating is not that unusual. In fact, she maintains that she's not at all ill or sick, and that her jogging, biking, Pilates, aerobics are all proof of her good health. This brings us to a second critical difference, the addition of ritualistic exercise to the symptom picture. Today's anorectic is not only restricting food and calories, she's expending enormous amounts of energy, deliberately burning calories in the form of physical activity that were not a part of the experience of women a century ago. I mean, a woman or girl who ran through the streets or parks of Ithaca in spandex even 75 years ago would have been considered quite eccentric and offbeat. Frenetic or ritualistic exercise, which is often socially sanctioned in today's world, means that contemporary women with anorexia nervosa are likely to be sicker and more compromised physically than those in the past. And in fact, I was able to compare admission weights in the 1930s with the 1980s at the Mayo Clinic. And despite all our knowledge and information about eating disorders, the 1980s patients were more emaciated and more troubled, probably as a result of two things, what I would call the exercise factor, and also, I would add, our increased tolerance for thinness. You know, our willingness to say, "Oh, but she looks lovely in her clothes," even though she's now under 100 pounds and is 5'4" or 5'5". You follow what I'm saying. We are more tolerant of an extremely slim body. The third change in the symptomatology is the introduction of bulimia. Since the 1980s, an increasing number of patients appear to mix bulimia with anorexia nervosa. This condition is often referred to as bulimia nervosa or bulimorexia. Historically, there's no evidence of the binge-purge syndrome in the past, a fact that set me to thinking about what the social and material circumstances of life for Victorian young women were like, and why it is that bulimia was unlikely a century ago. So let me begin by suggesting that the degree of privacy needed to support covert binging and purging was not generally available to young women in the Victorian era. If there was indoor plumbing, it was shared with family members. Chamber pots, the characteristic commode of the late 19th century, didn't hide chronic regurgitation and its telltale signs and smells. In addition, eating in the 19th century was centered around a fixed center of sociability, usually the family dinner table. The middle-class kitchen was the territory of domestic servants. Thus, it's difficult to conceive how a Victorian girl could have acted autonomously enough to secure large amounts of food on her own and then have the time to eat it undetected. Where did she binge? At tea while she was visiting? Among the servants who were working in the kitchen? Where did she secure large amounts of easily digestible food? Did she raid the larder when everyone was in bed? Was she able to purchase food items for herself whenever she wanted? On historical grounds, it seems to me that these opportunities simply were not available to Victorian young women, and that bulimia nervosa was probably not part of the symptom repertoire of that era. The characteristic binging and purging of the modern bulimic depends on personal freedom, such as your own car, bathroom, or apartment. It depends on a desocialized eating environment, what's often called grazing, lack of supervision, and the availability at almost any time of day of food for purchase. The autobiographies of former bulimics regularly mention picking up fast or prepared foods in supermarkets or convenience stores and eating alone in cars or other solitary settings. In this sense, the bulimic symptomatology mirrors and tragically mimics the autonomy and opportunity and freedom of contemporary young women. My review of the new symptomatology makes a theoretical point. If we approach anorexia nervosa from a purely biological perspective, it's hard to explain changes in symptomatology over time. But when we take into account the heightened cultural pressure to be thin, as well as changes in the role of women, changes in ideals of beauty, and what is a perfect body, the structure of the middle class household, and the state of technology, all of these things are not usually part of the biological model of disease, but we can see how the social and cultural climate prepared the ground for the new experience of the disease. Finally, I want to turn to the issue of why so many eating disorders now, and what it is about society and culture in the United States that generated, in the late 20th century, so much talk and so much pain around the issue of eating disorders. Certainly, the increasing emphasis on a slim female body is part of the story of why so many contemporary American women and girls regard being very thin as a form of female perfection. In The Body Project, which is a book I wrote after Fasting Girls, I described the evolution of a new way of thinking about the self, a shift from good works to good looks, which is pervasive in the diaries of 20th century girls. I also suggest that there have been many historical forces that contributed to our preoccupation with the body and an elevated level of self-scrutiny that led to the age of anorexia. And I'm just going to run through some of these and happily take questions afterwards. The invention of the calorie, and where's Mal Nesheim? got to read his new book, all right? The introduction of the modern bathroom, lights and mirrors, but also bathroom scales. Before World War II, most Americans did not have scales at home. People weighed themselves at drugstores, county and state fairs, using the same scales where they might weigh a heifer, and college gymnasiums. There are diaries here in the Cornell collection, which illustrate young women who came to campus to weigh themselves. Probably, I think, Gould, because of the wrestling team. They probably had a scale for that purpose. There's a famous Winslow Homer painting, by the way, of girls weighing themselves, standing in a line in a country store. And it's clear that there were huge bags of grain that had been were being weighed on the scale before them. But today, weighing is a private activity. Most women don't do that with even their friends. They do it at the doctor. That's about it. It's a private activity. The emergence of mass-produced clothing and standard sizing. Rather than personal seamstress who could hide and disguise your figure faults, people turned to mass-produced clothing, which had an impact on how we think about our bodies because we had a number, a size, that we had to deal with. The triumph of movie and celebrity culture. Moving images were very influential. In fact, the use of the word image and concern about image doesn't appear in girls' diaries until the 1920s, at exactly the moment when film culture takes off. And since the 1980s, I would add that fashion is increasingly revelatory, exposing more and more flesh and requiring more emphasis on sculpting. Beauty defined not so much by facial characteristics as by a flat abdomen and pelvis and critical body parts, which can, in fact, be for money changed with a medical intervention. And there's a lot of plastic surgery now, cosmetic surgery, among adolescent girls. So what about the numbers and who really has these disorders? Well, it's hard to discern because of all the conversation about weight in a society with so many, if you will, appearance junkies, and also a great deal of loose use of medical disease terminology. In my last couple of years teaching at Cornell, I had lots of students who would say to me, oh, I was anorexic. And I would say, explain to me what you mean by that. Well, what they meant is just for a while they didn't eat normally. Some people's eating disorders are only episodic. Others are, you know, subsumed into other diagnoses. Some harden into dangerous pathologies when they're left unaddressed. However, anorexia nervosa is not really an epidemic in the true sense of the word. I'm using the CDC definition. Recently, the NIH estimated that only 0.5 to 3.7% of women are ever diagnosed with it. And yet, by some very good estimates, 10 to 20% of American college women report eating disorders. People used to think that eating disorders were a lily white phenomenon that was restricted to just upper class young women. While there's some truth in this, especially with full blown anorexia nervosa, eating disorders have in recent years become much more democratic, small d, spreading across class and ethnic groups. When I started my book in the early 80s, I could find only one case of a three cases in England, young women of color, all of affluent African backgrounds who were going to elite schools in England, all right? Now there is a literature on African-American anorexia nervosa and bulimia, but I certainly hope not, but it would be much more likely that Malia and Sasha Obama would develop this disorder than someone who lives in poverty with a single mother in an urban ghetto. To my mind, social class trumps race and ethnicity in the story of anorexia nervosa. And I say that based on what we know about Jewish and African American girls. In both cases, as these ethnic groups have moved up the ladder of social mobility into the middle class, their daughters' risk for eating disorder is increased. Studies also show the same thing in London, where eating disorders appear in the second and third generation of Indian and Pakistani daughters. And I'd offer this point as a parallel observation, and that is that there are more eating disorders in the Ivy League than at Tompkins Cortland Community College. Two more brief observations about who gets anorexia nervosa. The age range is changing. It's dropping lower and extending later into life. We talk now of adult onset anorexia nervosa in middle-aged women. More young men are getting eating disorders. It's a logical consequence, I think, of the intensification of bodily perfection ideals. There appears to be more anorexia nervosa in the gay community. There's also a connection between anorexia nervosa and globalization. We have, in fact, imported the disease along with Coca-Cola and Big Macs to Japan, Brazil, China, Singapore, and Eastern Europe. And so finally, I want to return to one of my original questions. Why is anorexia nervosa so popular? I want to do this very briefly so that we have time for questions. And I've written an article called From Psychiatric Symptom to Communicable Disease. And the question I ask is, if you don't have a pathogen, how can you get to a communicable disease? I mean, there's nothing that's really spreading. So what's spreading here? I believe that anorexia nervosa has become catchy or contagious, even though there is no microorganism. According to a number of reputable studies, if you know someone with an eating disorder, you're more likely to develop one yourself. In some selective girls' schools and colleges, we might even talk about eating disorders as a psychic epidemic. I think this happened for a number of reasons. I think we inadvertently created an information environment that fostered the circulation of news about eating disorders in a reservoir of susceptible young women. This is a popularization process, getting the word out, keeping people informed, offering assistance. Some of this is useful and very important, but some of it is shallow, misleading, even seductive, in that it provides information on the practice of anorexia nervosa. And again, I'm talking here about fiction. There's one book in particular that sticks in my mind about a young girl who lived on Central Park West and who threw her dinner out the window for 4 months before her parents realized what was going on. A fictive story, but it was presenting techniques about how to hide food, how to get rid of it. People magazine makes anorexia their stock and trade for selling different issues, eating disorders. And most recently, we have the internet with its, there are sites, pro-ana, pro-anorexia, and pro-mia, pro-bulimia sites, which offer ideology and support to people with anorexia and bulimia who do not want to give up their symptoms. So we're dealing now with a kind of cyber self in all of this. We've also changed the experience of recovery and treatment so that it's no longer individual and isolated, but collectivized and social. Young people struggling with eating disorders generally seek individual counseling on an outpatient basis, but they can also attend eating disorders groups associated with hospitals and freestanding private clinics that offer residential inpatient treatment programs at considerable cost. This is a big issue in the insurance industry right now. These new, more social venues for treatment provide sufferers with opportunities to forge a sense of solidarity and a new identity as they explore their symptoms and motivations. I don't think all of this is bad, this collectivity and support. But we do need to acknowledge that along with our earnest effort to educate young women about eating disorders, there has also been a growing fascination with experiencing them. The communicability I'm talking about is social rather than biomedical, so it's not something that public health educators like to think about. In fact, it's unsettling for people who believe that education and information is always preventative. I certainly believe that about birth control. Yet, from a historical perspective, it's absolutely clear that no matter what the biological mechanism, eating disorders are largely cultural productions, and that young women in different historical eras always pick and choose from the existing disease repertoire in a way that illuminates their times. Thank you.
So Joan is willing to take questions, and we have about 15 minutes or so. So
good.
Why don't you want to call your own?
Cindy.
Joan, I have a question. What is the medical profession doing differently now that this is becoming well known?
That's a good question. There are a lot of ways to answer it. First, they're organizing themselves differently. There are specialists now within psychiatry, within adolescent medicine, who deal with eating disorders. For example, there is a special program at Strong Memorial Hospital now. That's about, I think, the closest one to us within academic medicine. Jeff, I think I'm right about this? Yeah. Of course, like psychiatry everywhere, they are turning to drugs, antidepressants in particular. In general, however, antidepressants work less well in anorexia nervosa than they do in bulimia. And the same is true with therapy groups. Young women with bulimia often, I know this, I will say, as an on-campus experience, that the groups that are run by Gannett and Psych Services, that they have a pretty good rate of success with bulimics, who of course are more social because they are sitting down to eat. They may eat and eat and eat and eat, okay, and go through the food line in the cafeteria more than normal, but they have more success in terms of drugs and also therapy. Anorexia nervosa is a very lonely and isolating condition in many cases. So I don't want to leave you with the impression that I think that group therapy is a bad thing for an anorexic, but I think it is a much more highly individualistic behavior. I'm trying to think of how else I can answer this, what doctors are doing. There's an enormous eating disorders establishment, an industry of private for-profit residential treatment centers. The best known are the Renfrew Centers, Miami, New York, Long Island, Philadelphia, started in Philadelphia. There's a movie by Lauren Greenfield who brought girl culture here to the Johnson Museum a number of years ago. She's done a movie called Thin. You can get it on Netflix. It's a horrible thing to suffer through, the movie, as well as the disease. But it's an inside a residential treatment center in Coconut Grove, Florida. And it's dealing with young women who are both anorexic and bulimic. And they range in age from 15 or 16 to my age. Those are big money makers, precisely because the insurance coverage doesn't always cover the kind of help that these young women need. And they do need help, and they need consistent, long-term psychotherapy. But as many of you know, our insurance system doesn't always provide for that. But there is a commercial aspect to it in these residential treatment centers. And university hospitals have a big interest in this as well. Yeah.
There are sort of two components to this. One is the fear of perhaps of looking too fat. Mm-hmm. But there's another component in this attracts attention, this behavior. And I wonder, is there a way of parsing those two things?
Well, remember, very good question. I'm not a therapist, right? I'm going to lay out, there are lots of psychological interpretations that range from somebody being obsessive about being thin to wanting attention, to being obsessive about control of everything, control, perfection being control of everything, to being too enmeshed with mom and dad and the family, to not wanting to grow up into an adult female body. That was the theory that Hilda Brook, the best known early theorist on anorexia nervosa, she was the one who postured that particular theory. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, there are all kinds of psychological reasons why an individual would choose to make her appetite her voice at a particular time in her life. And it's the untangling of her individual temperamental stuff with the larger social environment in which she's living. And then also considering, is there any biology involved here? I mean, just like it's hard for some of us to lose weight, for other people it's very easy to lose weight. Once you get into a certain kind of nutritional deprivation, some people assert that there is a high that comes with that, and then you can live on less and less and less. Okay, so there may be, there's an addiction model that's also projected. It's very complicated. And now there are people who are saying that they think that it could, this could be carried on a particular gene. And damn it, I forgot to look up the number, the name. I'm sorry. I should have remembered to do that before I came this morning. So the medical interpretations and the psychiatric interpretations are very broad, and you can get very different kinds of practitioners, you know, who have a particular read on what it is, and it may not be exactly the right fit for your daughter or granddaughter or yourself. So it's hard. Yeah?
I have questions about what happens to the social circle of the anorexic. And I'm thinking in particular about these women that you started studying in the 80s and the 90s and say they go on to marry, have children. Is there any such thing as, you know, anorexia by proxy? Are we seeing mothers who are looking at their children, especially their girl children, and having a distorted
mothers have been blamed for anorexia nervosa since the 19th century. In the earliest literature that I read, in the 1880s and 1890s, the doctors would say, well, the first published report of a death from anorexia nervosa, the doctors blamed on the mother coming to the hospital too often and being too involved in the daughter's case. And that's why the parentectomy seemed like such a good solution for some early doctors. Having said that, and having suggested that I think fathers ought to be considered as well as mothers. I think if you live in a household where there is an either overt or subtle obsession about weight, and the mother, in fact, takes diet pills or complains all the time about her thunder thighs, I think there can be passage of some cultural message from daughter to mother. But that's not, again, that's not always the case. It is sometimes. One of the things that you mentioned is, you know, having children. And that is one long-term consequence that people are beginning to look at, and that is whether or not fertility is affected by a long-term serious case of anorexia nervosa. And there's a lot of literature that has titles like, you know, what about anorexia nervosa 5 years afterwards? And the picture is not terribly good. You know, there's a high death rate. I think it has the highest mortality rate in any psychopathology that we've identified. On the other hand, if captured early teens, many people recover fully. So some of it has to do with age. Yeah?
Just as there's a predisposition
to recovery? You know, that's a really good question that I think you'd need to ask a therapist about. I mean, I certainly the kind of strengths that you bring to the therapeutic situation, the kind of family involvement, I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that question.
Have you noticed in your research any anorexic recovery linked to the development of other disorders later in time, like biomedical, such as endocrinological disorders or things along those lines?
No, I've never seen that in the literature. I have seen reports that, which I don't believe, and a lot of clinicians don't believe, is that a precursor is child abuse, sexual abuse. But that is clearly not the case in the general population. It may be true that there are people who are sexually abused who develop eating disorders, but it's certainly not something that you can generalize. Yeah.
Tony, you mentioned the singer Carpenter. What is a death rate, a peak death rate from AN?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand you.
How many young ladies are dying for a year as a result?
How many a year?
Yes.
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. I gave you the percentage from NIH is pretty low. You know, it's 0.2 to 3.7% of the population that has anorexia nervosa. But I don't really know what the, Jeff, are you?
I know people have studied it, but I don't know the numbers.
Is that 3.7% of the female population or the total?
Female population. Female population, yeah, yeah. I mean, I see everywhere the statement that the mortality rate in anorexia nervosa is higher than in any other psychopathology. But I don't really know what those numbers are, and I don't do that, you know, kind of data-driven research. So it's a mystery. But it contributes, I mean, to some of the kind of cultural, what would you say, interest in what this is all about and why it's become so popular. Yeah.
There's this talk recently about an obesity epidemic. I mean, that's very widespread.
Right.
I don't remember when we started using that language, but it seems to me it hasn't been more than a couple of decades. I could be wrong, but...
No, I think you're right.
Do you think that is contributing at all, that talk about obesity is this?
I don't think it contributes directly to the numbers of anorexics, but it's part of the larger culture, which is weight obsessed. And the obesity epidemic, if there is an epidemic, again, I'm going to defer to my colleague, Jeff Sobel, what you think about this. There are many more poor people in this country who are fat than rich people. So there are class distinctions to be made here. And I think Americans use the term epidemic very loosely. What about now the ADHD epidemic or the autism epidemic? I mean, when I teach in summer college, I'm teaching kids, the course is called Mind, Body, and Health, Historical Perspectives for Future Professionals. So you can guess who's drawn in there. There are all these kids who want to be doctors and clinicians, and they all come convinced that there is an autism epidemic and that there's another kind of epidemic, and they want to learn about these epidemics, which don't fit the CDC guidelines. But obesity, the rates have been soaring in such a way that I think that's the fear, although it's very specific geographically. I mean, there's not much obesity in Ithaca as there would be in somewhere in Alabama, right? The red states are more likely to be.
Don't bring politics.
I know. Susan.
I need a comment and also a question. You were talking about where I spoke. for, you might have a girls' school, and there you would create a community where this
right.
was popular.
Right.
And now it seems so scary over pro-am sites where you have anonymous, huge communities.
Huge.
And I know they're always trying to shut those sites down, but they pop up with different names. And that seems to me, I mean, so scary. And the other thing I was wondering is if you could speak more about anorexia in very different cultures.
Oh, in different cultures. I don't know a hell of a lot about, actually, the Japanese were the first kind of non-American case that I knew about. And now Brazil has a very expansive numbers. Again, related to the fact that Brazil also has one of the highest cosmetic surgery rates in the world, and an enormous emphasis on bodily perfection. The Japanese never quite did that, and yet they seem to have had a lot of anorexia nervosa, and people, I once heard Arthur Kleinman from Harvard Medical School, who writes about in medical anthropology, make the point that the Japanese family would be a good model, a good example of family enmeshment. So, you know, I think there are probably different cultural pieces in different cultures that contribute to why a particular cohort will develop this. There's a stunning study by, I guess she's not so young anymore, but I'll just say a medical anthropologist named Becker of Samoa, or some South Pacific island. Do you
Fiji?
Thank you. You know about this. Oh, you met her. Great. All right. So correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't reviewed this in a while, but this was a culture where being robust, okay, was correlated with positive emotions. All right. It was a symbol of a man's success if his daughters and wife were large, all right? I mean, that's the traditional pre-industrial model. Well, they brought TV to Fiji, and 2 years later, they had young women who were dieting and thought they were too fat. Very, you know, tightly constructed field work and very nicely done. Anything else from that study that you can remember? Nothing. You ate food because you were hungry. You were responding to satiety, and you know.
And then I think that after the introduction of television, the rates were even higher than they were in other places like here. And they had the most compelling part of the research was the individual case studies. I would say talking about girls who would purge after eating, which was just completely an unheard of behavior. And I think that Fiji's still struggling.
That was TV, just TV. This was before the internet.
Well, thank you very much. Do you have any questions?